fear and in anger. I was born from fire. That'll never stifle. I will never surrender. I will never yield. I will never be conquered. You will never.
Welcome to Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied America / Turtle Island.
This is an autonomous anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Maltioch, see your Siju relatives. This is your co-host, Anthony Choice. Yes, coming to you from the sweatbox that is my bedroom in occupied Ohlone territory, a.k.a. Silicon Valley.
Yat et asinflo, this is Kli Benali coming at you from occupied Flagstaff, Kinflene, in so-called Arizona at the base of the holy San Francisco peaks, Dineta. I am one of your co-hosts today.
Oka, hello everybody. My name is Bon, and I'm one of the co-hosts of this show today. I'm also here in occupied Kinklane, and my homelands are where the border crossed Arizona and Mexico.
You have no authority. You will never win.
So with this broadcast, we are focused on voting, specifically not voting, and how voting is not a form of harm reduction in the context of colonial rule, domination, and exploitation. We published a zine about this issue at the beginning of this year that digs into a bit of the history of colonial assimilation strategies against Indigenous folks to undermine our sovereignty and how that plays out today, as well as pose some questions in that zine regarding ways that we can further Indigenous autonomy. So initially we were going to read sections of that zine here, but Bon has so awesomely stepped up and recorded an audio version of that that will be a companion broadcast for this podcast. So with that, we are going to have an open discussion. We're going to dig into some of the analysis, maybe some disagreements, and have some questions regarding our experiences and issues around voting. So welcome to our guest, Bettina.
Greetings, Sego. I'm originally from occupied Haudenosaunee territories. I live and reside in occupied Diné territories, the border of the Northern Agency, about 20 miles east of Shiprock. And thank you for having me. And this is such an important topic, and I look forward to this discussion about the vote, about being sucked into a system that we feel we need to support and know it's not good. You know, that like you were describing, rocking the vote. I remember voting and feeling like, you know, yeah, we need to do this, and feeling those things that you're talking about. But also feeling very bad that I was participating in their system, in my gut, a conflict. And it is a relief to let go of those things and address the colonial system, supporting the colonial system by voting. You are supporting that system, and the only way for us to have self-governance is to tear down that system. Democratic and Republican parties, what I try to tell people is it's the wings of the same bird, and that bird is a settler colonial regime that disguises itself as a democratic republic. In actuality, voting for the lesser of two evils has had little to no effect on assisting Indigenous and marginalized people in what they call this free democratic republic, America. So pledging allegiance to and supporting a colonial settler regime government by a vote for one part or the other that has done barely any notable efforts of reparations of the existing effects of genocide is not a way to be counted. It's not a way to make a difference. It's not a way to repair. It's not a way to restore and gain true sovereignty and true self-governance. I could blow this into a way bigger proportion because I don't think Americans who think they're free are free, and I don't think they really know what freedom is.
And that's a really critical part of this discussion, that when we talk about voting, we have to talk about this concept of democracy and what its genealogy is. And a lot of Indigenous folks celebrate the adaptation as well as, or the appropriation really, of the concept of democracy from the Six Nations, when really it's just a perversion that is disembodied from those original teachings and then has been projected outwards in what we experience today as anything but a democratic experience. And so historically, we see Indigenous autonomy and power systematically being attacked by this concept of democracy, which is just a colonial function and one that seeks to fold Indigenous people into it as citizens and then perpetuates this electoral process, which really disembodies everyone but the ruling class elite's power. And that is Indigenous folks, it's Black folks, it's other folks of color who this system was never designed to benefit or to serve. And so we have to be clear about that, because we look at the Electoral College, we look at majority rule, and we look at this overall history. This is the reality of American democracy. This is what we have to understand when people try to say voting is sacred or try to say your vote counts. When we look at the architecture or the framework of this democratic project, which really is never designed to serve any of us.
I think something that's really been sticking out to me over the last couple of months, and what Bettina kind of mentioned too, is that voting offers no solutions towards autonomy or self-governance. You know, since the pandemic hit, I've seen more happen in the last 6 months that contributes to our autonomy and self-governance through mutual aid than I have, you know, in the 28 years of my life. It's just seeing that in the last 6 months really, I think, paves the way for how I can envision a future where we do have autonomy and self-governance. And I think that that piece about the victimhood in what is known as, like, this democracy really speaks a lot to a lot of the issues that we see happen since we've entered this, you know, post-apocalyptic dystopia since Contact, and how the victim blaming really kind of like eludes all of these consequences. I think a lot about how victim blaming informs the MMIWG2ST epidemic and how we really treat people as responsible for their own oppression and their own violence, when really it's the colonial oppressor that's been enacted for the last 500, 600 years that's done the most damage, and that cannot be prepared by voting for someone who participates in this colonial structure.
Yes.
Anthony, what do you got to say about this?
Well, I guess I'm the fly in the ointment, so to speak. But I think we agree more than we disagree, because when I look at it, as I look at it just at a much at a deeper level, beyond the vote, casting a vote as a political act within a device, some kind of political device that accomplishes something in an institution. In reality, what I always try and tease out is what I call the abjectivity of something. Abjectivity in the sense of like abject poverty, where it's so obvious and apparent and bottom line that that's where things really are at. And the abjective situation of voting in this country has nothing to do with liberation. What it is voting as a hostage situation. And what I mean by that is it's overtly coercive, particularly as far as indigenous people are concerned. But we are in a structure of overt, direct settler occupying colonialism. And as a result of that, there is monopolies upon certain things, specifically resources and access to those resources that has to do and can only be dealt with within the realm of civility, if you will, within the realm of voting. When we reduce it to just ideas of just the leaders and whatever, what's negated with that and the notion of harm reduction is I don't even buy into the notion of harm reduction. If the sense of understanding is that is actual politics versus just one form of political activity and how power functions. Because we could equally as much create change in the streets as we can on the ground or through the vote, or as they're so often said, you know, they're not going to change anything with a vote. But the point being that instead of ceding part of the political landscape, I believe utilizing the political landscape to achieve certain ends with the one proviso, which is that understanding that Project America, the great American experiment, City on the Hill, has fuck all to do with indigenous autonomy and everything to do with indigenous oppression. But the point being, that's still the hostage taker. So how do you negotiate out from that what you need? And in the present moment versus in an idealized form of total liberation. Some indigenous nations, for example, may have the capacity where they can actually ignore voting altogether. It's indifferent to the benefits of the lives of the people doing it. And then the inverse of that is that others don't have that same level of control in order to obtain access to resources, monies, what have you. And a moralistic stance doesn't change the situational of asymmetric power on the one hand. And then the other thing is the political moment of the now. In the political moment of the now, political engagement is a necessity in one way or another. Either you're an accelerationist, meaning you want the system to collapse in and of itself as rapidly as possible in whatever way possible, which is fine, or you aren't necessarily acting to preserve the system as you are trying to actually, like it says, harm reduction, but not in the traditional sense. This is a different scenario. This isn't just the lesser of two evils. This is fascism versus covert fascism. The state as a covert fascist or authoritarian entity, we already know what that is. This is an occupying state. The difference with overt fascism is, regardless of radical or liberal participation, the targeting becomes the radical. And so in a fascist environment, we are enemy number one no matter what. Whereas in a liberal environment, we're not necessarily enemy number one because they're too busy infighting with one another.
The vote does not count. If you look back into voting history in our generations, marginalized people, people of a certain poverty level, you know, long-term objective data about just even working families, poor people, oppressed, marginalized, exploited, they don't benefit from either party's victory. And start by looking at income inequality, education inequality, medical care inequality, food source inequality. So these points are important about, you know, the history of my mother's people, you know, Haudenosaunee, and these things that are all on paper in their halls of their academies and their government buildings. But our vote has not counted, and not just our vote. The Americans, you know, they were all colonized before they brought their tax-paying population here. And even the majority of the dominant culture's vote doesn't count, because what they're voting for doesn't happen. It's a broken system. Colonial settler regimes are not real. Their disguise is a democratic republic. It's like a mask. There's nothing democratic about any nation founded on genocide. And if you don't make repairs and own it, don't continue to call yourself a democratic republic. Under God. You know? What nation under their God commits the amount of atrocious things that have happened on this continent and doesn't make huge efforts of reparation? That's a system that needs to be torn down.
You know, all those tactics of assimilation and, you know, forgetting who we are and participating in, you know, this system that is so a so-called democracy. There's no way to separate overt and covert fascism. And that's kind of, I wanted to bring that back a little bit to what Anthony was saying, because there's no part of our existence in so-called America that doesn't, in my perspective, doesn't perpetuate fascism. And so to say that something is like overt or covertly fascism, I think contributes to this idea that harm reduction can exist in this settler colonial state. And I just really don't agree with that.
To understand voting, we have to understand the history of it, especially in relation to Indigenous people. And we have to look at the Indian Citizenship Act. We have to look at the Indian Reorganization Act and really understand them for what they were at the time, as they were strategies that were specifically created to assimilate Indigenous people and to undermine our sovereignty. This process that initially was violent of forcing Indigenous people to become U.S. citizens and was widely rejected at its time is something that was specifically designed to attack Indigenous sovereignty and to facilitate mass-scale land theft. And this is part of the history that is completely ignored by a lot of these Indigenous nonprofits who are getting mass foundation paychecks to get out the Native vote, but they're not looking critically at our history and finding ways to put those resources into supporting and sustaining Indigenous autonomy. You know, if we read the Indian Citizenship Act, which is extremely short, and we look at the context, what precipitated that act and what the implications of it were, and the resistance from Tuscarora, from Haudenosaunee, and a range of other Indigenous nations, you know, we understand a different dynamic and application of that act. It was actually a regulatory move that was created with no hearings, and it was really an imposition. One of the actually advocacy groups called the Indian Rights Association at the time, which was really promoted by this guy, Henry S. Pancoast. He was the founder of the group. It was actually a Christian white supremacist group called the Indian Rights Association. And he stated, quote, "Nothing besides United States citizenship will so tend to assimilate the Indian and break up his narrow tribal allegiance as making him feel that he has a distinct right and voice in the white man's nation." And so his advocacy was actually really part of what shaped the Indigenous or the policies relating to Indigenous people at the time. The IRA, or the Indian Rights Association, their objective was to, quote, "bring about the complete civilization of the Indians and their admission to citizenship." So they really considered themselves reformists and lobbied Congress at the time to establish the boarding school system, to pass the Dawes Act, to reform the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and of course to, as I mentioned, pass the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. So to me, this is part of the genealogy of the Native vote, is actually to fulfill the colonial project of indigenous genocide.
The Citizens Act, I always, well, my mother used to joke how it was a act of convenience. and she would explain it as it was for their benefit and it was convenient for them. It had nothing to do with helping indigenous people. Or things would be in a greater state of repair today.
One of the other reasons that the acts took place, the assimilationist policy took place, was there was actually concrete legal resistance to the draft. So what they literally wanted to do is they wanted to make American Indians into citizens so as they can recruit them into war. Because the first people that were able to actually cite treaties and go, I actually have no obligation to sign up for your war, were Native people. So legislation of convenience is 100% accurate.
Yeah.
Did it to circumnavigate that.
Very, very good point about the draft.
And then of course that, as we know, isn't exactly new. They just modified the mythology of like participation as the new warriorhood, if you will. And we've been celebrating that, or certain portions of our community have been celebrating that for decades since, and over a century now. Having said that, getting back to the idea of moralism, the moralism, what I mean is actually about the question of sovereignty. And that's really what it gets down to, is not voting a anti-colonial act, A. B, in so doing, are you actually empowering Native sovereignty and or autonomy? And at the deepest level, like, you could talk about the actual policies that people are voting on or individual candidates that people are voting on. I actually argue that that's immaterial. The core argument itself, if indeed the belief is that this is an anti-colonial position and that it is actually in some way, shape, or form building on autonomy and sovereignty with the Native people, it negates the fact of all the other shit we participate in, voluntarily or non-voluntarily, that is equally as establishing in terms of as an assimilationist project. And in this sense, it's assimilation like the Borg in Star Trek. It's assimilating us into the state through our own subject creation. It could be going to court, filing papers at court, getting a driver's license, getting a wedding license, you name it. Any form of bureaucratic participation that is a necessity to function in this society constitutes a participation within the colonial structure. Voting or not voting is just one act amongst a myriad of other everyday acts that we participate in that actually reinforce the state on a constant basis. And again, that's a hostage situation, because most of us, it's not like we don't live under capitalism, right? So capitalism forces us into a situation in which we have to participate in the economy in one way, shape, or form. And in order to do so, we have to play by certain rules. And those rules are being imposed upon us. That's the hostage situation, because there's something on the other side of those rules that we need, be it the ability to drive a vehicle and not get arrested for driving said vehicle, to registering your child when it's born. And there's no doubt that what Bettina is saying is absolutely true. That's the third question. The third question is, why are we even, like, we could actually look at the American project as an object, step outside of it, and as Native people, we have every right to do that. We probably should be doing that, because I would argue that not only is the American project an abject failure and in its death throes at this very moment, but arguably Western civilization is going through the same thing. It's a diseased and dying near corpse. And I would actually say it's a zombie in and of itself at the moment. And they want us to be neo-colonial sycophants that uphold this, you know, this zombie state. And in reality, what we should be doing instead is looking at it for what it is and saying, well, this thing, whatever your delusions you're trying to pitch, it's still a failure. It fails for you. It fails for even the principles that you claim it's supposed to do. On every single level, it cannot accomplish any of the things that it says it does. What it does accomplish are these things. And the first people who have seen that from literally moment one are Native people. I've been seeing exactly what this state has been about from the outset, which quite literally made us into enemies from the beginning. You know, we were the savages outsider, and then within their own notion of subject building, they weren't even acknowledging the form of the subject they would create and recognize in the form of treaties, because they dismissed every treaty. But by the same token, versus how they would objectify the black body, we would become part of the flora and fauna. So we weren't even given a personhood within the United States context. And so
I don't even have to address the two-party system, but there's their government colonial system. Like, if you look at it in the last 40 years, one of the sharpest increases of inequality was in the early 90s, okay? When that was considered the most unified democratic control the federal government had had, okay? And so then in the later years with George Bush, it rose again, right? It rose again sharply under Obama. So it doesn't really matter what party's in charge, does it?
Not at all.
The famous quoted 0.1% of the population grabbing, you know, a certain, you know, the majority of society's wealth. You know, I ask American citizens that support their regime, you might want to learn a little bit about what democratic republic means. I've said this over and over, like, you believe it because it's printed on coin and it's printed on papers and you learn it in school. You know, you don't even know who your ancestors are.
When you look at, like, politics as an institution, you really need to view it through the lens of capitalism. Because, like, you know, we had Bernie Sanders out there for the working class people and this and that, but at the end of the day, he was still a politician. He had, you know, thousands, if not 10,000s of poor working class people donate $5 of their dollars to his campaign, which I don't know how many millions of dollars he ended up raising. And then he drops out of the race, like, last minute. I don't totally know. I don't follow politics. I don't give a shit about them. So I don't know exactly what happened there. But I just think that people really need to understand that politics and politicians are really just, you know, one of the cogs in this, like, capitalism machine. And so, yeah, Anthony, like you were saying, we have to participate in colonialism in some ways in order to just survive by having a driver's license or having a place to live, or being documented. But I don't think that means that we have to consent to spending really any part of our lives participating in the political aspects of the so-called democracy. I think it's honestly just a waste of time. And like I have already said, I've seen more done in the last 6 months than I have in my entire life for Black and Indigenous people. So I think if our moral perception is really coming into question, I don't think morality has anything to do with participating in politics at all. I actually think it's like if we really wanted to question people's morality outside of just having to survive, I don't think that we can do it within the framework of, you know, this politic. So really what you're doing, I think, when you have the belief that any kind of voting for a bill or a law or an ordinance or a local politician, really all you're doing is empowering capitalism. And so we know that's not going to lead us to our autonomy or self-governance whatsoever. So I just really don't see the point in spending time learning about any of this shit.
But there's a lot of folks who were attracted to the Bernie Sanders campaign because they were looking at, you know, democratic socialism as part of the ticket. So, like, you're saying that, you know, you're voting for capitalism, but, you know, here's all these people, like, you know, especially the right, like, you know, branding Sanders as this radical, like, socialist, when clearly, you know, I think especially what you're speaking to is that nothing could have been further from the truth. But yeah, it's just something that I was extraordinarily surprised how many radical friends and, you know, accomplices I've had from over the years were on the Bernie Sanders train. And just really, it was disturbing because they were just so, I think most of it was just really driven by fear. Like, it was like, well, what alternative to Trump is there? What viable alternative to, like, this current political reality that we're facing is there, aside from somebody who could potentially beat him on that political level? And to me, you know, I had a lot of arguments about power relationships and how that further entrenches colonial rule. Like if we're not actually going deep enough, especially if we're radicals, that's what we're charged to do, is actually go to the root causes and dig as deep as possible. And to me, it was really disappointing to hear how many folks just signed up to that campaign based on those concepts. But I think there's a fallacy of the idea of even, you know, Sanders as a socialist candidate within that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I have some radical friends who are, like, surprised by some of the things that AOC has said or has done. And here I am going, you know, like, Black and Indigenous people have been saying the same things about politics in our kitchens, in our communities, in our neighborhoods. We've been having these conversations for, you know, who knows how many decades now. But since, you know, AOC said it at the Capitol or whatever, somehow it's suddenly, like, legitimate. And, like, all those things have, you know, those videos and stuff have millions and millions and millions of views, when actually she said nothing that radical Black and Indigenous people haven't been saying for a long time now. And so I just see that, you know, pinning our hopes or our visions for the future on these politicians who, once again, are still participating in the settler colonial so-called democracy, are just kind of, you know, I don't know, at a loss for, like you said, Klee, what the root causes of our oppression really are.
I think the assumption behind the assumption made about a capitalist state is that voting can bring on social change. It can't. A capitalist state doesn't and hasn't. People think that, you know, who they're going to vote for, that in this capitalist, you know, colonial regime, that those people can be used for social change. and that electing that right official, it's an assumption that people have made, or a lie they've been made to believe through, you know, the propaganda and these campaigns. And we've got dominant historical capitalism here. It's a culture of capitalism and politics. Anyway, I just wanted to add that point. That, you know, you've got a lot of citizens that were believing in social change, like Baum was saying with Sanders, and then he bows out and then endorses Biden. None of that's about social change.
Engineering for failure. I think that, like, there's been a lot of different topics hit on all at once very briefly. For one, I do think a lot of people overvalue and overthink the vote as it related to candidates. Sometimes it's petty. So, for example, like I always cite, why did I vote for Barack Obama? In the end, it had nothing to do with any of the politics. I sat in the voting booth and said, is this going to make a cracker angry? And I said, yes, it will. And so I just like the idea of some racist white person having a conniption because a black man was now president. Now, and I live in California, so for all intents and purposes, my vote doesn't count at all because it's a foregone conclusion. So I didn't even value it in that grandiose sense. Having said that, what's really the question is, like, are we going to get caught up in the trappings of democracy in the 4-year cycle of democratic distraction? Or what we're really discussing is power, and that voting in this country and the state and its apparatiques, if you will, are just one form of political decision making and power. I totally agree that it doesn't make social change. I mean, at its best, it's a reformist project or mechanism. But in the sense of where I look at things, it isn't a value statement from me saying I believe in voting or have a moral position or I believe in the American project or any of that stuff. What it actually, I look at things in terms of tactical and strategic reasons. Where does power lie? And so in certain situations, again, there's a monopoly of power around a certain subject or resource or item that has to be engaged with, and that's the only way it can be engaged with. It is one among many avenues in which power is confronted, adjusted, and tweaked. And the reason I say that is because when we get back to the notion of capitalism, one of the big mistakes people make is they assume capitalism is just this economic form, that it's just a market thing that we engage with, the exchange of monies and goods and things like that. That's not what it is. Capitalism is its own logic, and it's a matrix of amorphous absorption, meaning what it does, its very creation and its existence thrives on the absorption of everything. If it's not as a commodified object that can be marketized and commodified, made something exchanged for money, then what it does is it transforms it into a logic that it can actually function within capitalism, including identity, including politics. So in other words, it supersedes politics in every single way, but it isn't about the values of just where the money goes. It's actually how we think of and look at the way politics functions. And because really what we're talking about is a system in which there is a belief on some level that it's transactional. That's the notion. Like if you study standard political theory, they talk about things like the social contract and
Hey, no academics.
No academics. Well, I'm just saying that's their notion of it, right? The self-mythologizing of representative democracy. Whereas we know that representation has actually been the main thing that democracy has meant to hinder, not enable, to hinder, to make sure that certain people were not represented and could not function within it. If it was gender-based, where women had no vote, for example, and if it's based on the colonial pretext or the slavery pretext, now the immigrant pretext, the immigrant is the ultimate outsider of the system, right? That's what the system is actually there to do, to perpetuate exclusion, not inclusion in terms of anything. But my thing is, like I said, it is about power. So how are we challenging power in any way, shape, or form? And where are the gains to be made, or to, like Bond said, to enable survival for certain people? And in some ways, that means that there has to be participation or nothing else happens.
And I don't agree with that. I don't think it's that black and white. I don't think it's and nothing else happens.
Power comes in people organizing. There's more, humans have more power than they've been led to believe. You know, that's part of the assimilation and the breakdown of the spirit. You know, we can do incredible things. Our capabilities are vast. The tools we have today are huge.
And this is really what this conversation is about. This is about power. When we talk about citizenship, we talk about voting, we talk about democracy, we're talking about power. And so I assert that voting in the colonizers' elections keeps Indigenous peoples powerless. And I want to, you know, challenge this sort of black and white notion that you're framing it as, Anthony. You know, it's like if we don't participate and we don't, you know, because we are, your point is that we are actively participating on some level just by having a driver's license or, the act of driving or, you know, birth certificate, social security cards. You know, I have elders still that don't have any documentation, and we have many people in the communities that we live in who are Indigenous, who have migrated, who don't have any documentation on any level. And we navigate this world, this existence outside of that. And this isn't just idealistic. It's actually part of what is built into this American democratic project in the Electoral College, which is just exclusionary majority rule, and also doesn't work in practice, because if you look at some of the previous elections where the popular vote was undermined by the Electoral College. And so what we see is the complete omission of political participation and the power of a lot of folks who are underage, they're not old enough to vote, who are deemed mentally unfit to participate in that system, who have some kind of criminal history that prohibits them from engaging in participating in that political system. And so what we're saying here is that our autonomy should not be mediated through a system and by politicians and their laws that are selected through whatever process to represent Indigenous interest. It is disingenuous, and ultimately it does not benefit us. And that intentionally silences a whole lot of folks. When people say, oh, if you don't vote, you can't complain. Well, a lot of people can't complain already just because of the way the system operates. But we do complain because we won't be silenced because of this paternalistic attitude of those who have some rights and assume and assert those practices by supporting and perpetuating the system. But getting back to the point about identification, birth certificates, and so forth, as far as participating in this system, and therefore you're already indicted, so why not vote? One is about survival, and the other is about sanctioning and furthering the political death of our people. Additionally, what we're leaving out here is how do our spirits survive when we're talking about, you know, this process? And where does our power come from? And so what I wrote in the zine was that our power, broadly speaking, does not come from non-consensual majority rule, top-down man-made laws, but is derived in relation with and proportion to all living beings. you know, this is a corporeal and spiritual power that has been in effect since time immemorial and is what has kept indigenous peoples alive in the face of more than 500 years of extreme colonial violence. And I understand the strategic, on a strategic level, how we need to recognize that that's how power works right now under colonial occupation. So what ways, especially if we're looking at cleaning up abandoned uranium mines, you know, I mean, if we can't organize to do it ourselves and figure out the resources and material resources to be able to do that, we're going to have to convince those politicians who are responsible for permitting that to happen in the first place, because the corporations aren't going to do it willfully unless we do find a way through direct action to organize ourselves to clean up those mines in our communities. But I would, you know, as long as settler colonial politicians in the system exists, I want to hold them accountable to it. But I don't feel like voting is the way to do it. To me, it's about challenging them as directly as possible, intervening, and to the point where our communities can organize to address those issues as directly as possible. So that's what I choose to do. Instead of voting, I organize to intervene as directly as possible in the root causes that uphold this dominant social order while working to creatively build and support alternatives that really are, you know, based in mutual aid. You know, because I think that, you know, few folks go to the voting booth and understand the context and political implications of citizenry and voting. They just simply assume it to be a civic duty. But they willfully fulfill the colonial intent to completely destroy indigenous autonomy through that. And to me, voting is a colonizer religion. I think we need to understand it on spiritual terms because we are spiritual people. So to me, it's about pledging indigenous hearts and minds to colonial authority. And as long as we are doing that, so that this isn't just about like getting a driver's license and all that, it's actually actively making that decision to support, to perpetuate this system through that pledge that we lose our hearts and we lose our minds to, and we subject it to colonial authority. Reformism disarms, it pacifies, it assumes that there's something salvageable in this system, that there is something good. It's conciliatory by nature. And to me, I don't want any reconciliation with this system. We actually live in spite of the system, not due to it. And I really believe that we're only limited by our creativity when we ask and answer the questions, what can we do to directly address our needs and the needs of those in our communities? And what ways can we directly intervene in the rooted violences that uphold this system? So I'm not interested in the governance of settler colonizers. I'm interested in that space of ungovernability that is indigenous, that is spiritual, that is rooted in the land. Our authority comes from a covenant with creation, with nature, and we operate from consultation with that process through ceremony, through our prayers. And there's nothing, you know, our spirit doesn't survive when we calculate it through participating through this process as indigenous people. And I think we need to approach it that way. It's a way that is ungovernable. And to me, it's really this sort of concept of unmapping the geography of who we are and how we relate to each other through the imposition of colonial violence. And I don't think there's anything idealistic about it because I see it operating still in the community that I originally come from to this very day.
My relationship to voting has definitely, I think, been informed by, you know, my origin story of being the child of a missing indigenous woman. You know, that happened when I was very young. I was like 10 years old when she got deported from, you know, the northern part of our homeland to the southern part of our homeland. But anyway, crossed that border there. And then she just went missing after that. And so that was like 18 years ago. And I became incarcerated into the, you know, American foster care system and, you know, was forced to assimilate in this and that just to survive. And because of that mechanism of colonialism, you know, breaking our spirits and my spirit, I was super, you know, disillusioned by how to prevent that from happening to anyone else. Because let me tell you, it was like quite a hell to go through and somehow come out the other side. So of course, you know, I thought that if I could prevent that from happening to anyone, that it could happen through, you know, putting people into office that, don't believe in deportation and believe in the working class and, you know, all these things. And so I got pretty active into the political system here in occupied Kinklane, and even was like the strategizer for some campaign that was in 2016, I think it was. It was for raising the minimum wage. And so I got really involved in that. But I was also doing a lot of, I think, kind of like a lot of learning in that time, too, about, you know, anti-fascism and stuff like that. And so I was like on, in one way, participating in the political system, but also like starting to realize like that that was not it. That was really not it. And so anyway, you know, the ballot that I was working on passed, and it felt like kind of a hollow victory in a lot of ways. And then there was like, you know, I gained some recognition from the liberals here in so-called Flagstaff. A lot mostly because of like my story and being tokenized. The liberals here really liked to use me as a way to gain recognition for their own political platforms. And I kind of really had my last straw with that. I got some like meaningless award as one of like the people who have so made history happen here in so-called Flagstaff, but they didn't actually want to share the gritty details of my story and why I do the things that I do. And so they just kind of like put this veil of easily digestible information into my story in the museum exhibit. And that's kind of when I was like, all right, you know, fuck all these people. They don't actually give a shit about me. They just see me as someone whose story is really sad that they want to uplift in their own meaningless way. And then, yeah, it just took, for me, it took like actually experiencing the charade that is politics and that is government to really see that it didn't really do anything at all to improve my life or the lives of really anybody around me, and actually in a lot of ways made them worse. I think it's interesting how people see politics in this kind of like linear way that it's going to eventually get better, when like I haven't seen anything really get better or change at all in this whole like, well, women fought for their right to vote and indigenous people fought for their right to vote, so you should participate in that system, is really just a farce. And so, yeah, that's kind of like my story around voting and why I think it's just pretty much a crock of shit, and why I think people should... I mean, why use any space in your spirit and your mind and your body, even if it's a strategy to you? Like, I just don't understand the desire to spend any amount of energy in this lifetime voting. It just doesn't make any actual sense to me, when it so clearly has failed just failed and has made things worse for some people over the years. So I really am dumbfounded when people really advocate for the vote.
I wanted to thank you for just sharing such a personal and profound story and tragic one relating to your mom and your experience, Bon, because it takes a lot to open up, and I know it propels a lot of what you do. So I just wanted to acknowledge that and thank you for sharing.
Yeah, of course.
I wanted to as part of the, going back to the zine, voting is not harm reduction, because we barely scratched the surface of a lot of the stuff that I wrote about in there. But I address the suffragist movement because you mentioned that a lot of folks like lean back historically. It's just like, well, people fought and died for our right to vote. So we have to, that's part of our civic duty. It's like, actually the suffragist movements fought for equal participation in a political system, but failed to indict and abolish the systems of oppression that underpinned that settler colonial society. So like after decades of organizing, it was white women who celebrated suffrage in 1920, which was granted in part as part of the reward for service in World War One. You know, so Anthony, I think you referenced the military dimensions of voting and citizenry. This is an important part of that. Your cis heteropatriarchy was not indicted or dismantled, and Black folks were purposefully disregarded in their campaigning. And that dimension of anti-Blackness actually, you know, is an interesting, you know, complex issue that's folded up into Indigenous identity, because Indigenous folks historically have had a position more in proximity to whiteness and being accepted and assimilated, whereas Black folks were completely disposable, you know, viewed either as, you know, a commodity as slaves, you know, for enslavement, in exploitation of their labor, or just completely disposable and not in proximity to whiteness. So, you know, that history has to be addressed, because the five civilized tribes, you know, even had anti-Black political relationship that still is playing out today with the freedmen. So, you know, they're, you know, politically excluding people and using identity, you know, the sort of like identification of who is Indigenous, who isn't Indigenous, to exclude people from, you know, in robbing them of their political power. And we see that even with, you know, Indigenous folks in so-called California, where disenrollment is used as a political weapon against folks who just aren't in political agreement with folks who are basically making capitalist maneuvers with managing casino funds and revenues. So I think the dimensions in the history is important. And to reference Lucy Parsons, who is an Afro-Indigenous anarchist, was among many who critiqued suffrage at the time. Like Parsons actually wrote in 1905, quote, "Can you blame an anarchist who declares that man-made laws are not sacred? The fact is money and not votes is what rule people. And the capitalists no longer care to buy the voters. They simply buy the servants after they've been elected to serve. The idea is that the poor man's vote amounts to anything is the veriest delusion. The ballot is only the paper veil that hides the tricks." And you know, I mean, we haven't even dug into, like, you know, Malcolm X's position with the ballot or the bullet, which I think is important to explore in relation to the time of the 50s and 60s, especially, you know, culminating with the 1965 Voters' Rights Act. But, you know, Black nationalists at the time were very critical of it, and very militant. You know, part of the point is that so long as the political and economic system remains intact, voter enfranchisement, though perhaps resisted by overt white supremacists, is still welcome so long as nothing about the overall political arrangement fundamentally changes. You know, this is the facade of political equality, that it can occur under violent occupation, but liberation can never be found in the occupier's ballot box. In this context, the settler colonialism voting is a civic duty of maintaining our own oppression. And I assert that you can't decolonize the ballot box. The process of undoing colonization will not occur by voting. I do want to ask, like, what y'all think, you know, because there are a lot of folks who are concerned with this election. They are concerned with the potential for Trump winning. There are also a lot of folks concerned with, you know, Biden winning. I'm curious as to what your position is. Like, what are you saying to people who are so caught up in that fear and wanting to make sure that it's sort of anybody but Trump in this upcoming election, which I think a lot of folks are obviously concerned about?
I think most of the people I've already scared away with my politics, because I'm a kind of an unrepentant accelerationist. I really don't care who wins. Either one's bad. Either one's going to, you know, deepen the shithole, as it were. And I'm all for that. The more dysfunctional this place becomes, the better. Because inevitably, what I need is people to acknowledge that it's a failure and then want, imagine, and work towards something different. You know, abandon this disaster piece that is, you know, the American settler project. The only other item was, even with their own political analysis, I'm very curious to see what happens in November. That's really all it is. Other than that, my recommendation to people is, to be honest, have a self-defense posture, because unrepentant and violent terroristic racism is the only outcome we know for sure is going to come out of it, regardless of who wins, because that's how, you know, that's what we know. They've already been emboldened. They're already enacting stuff. It's just inevitable. And the two groups, I mean, we're obviously not white people. So we already know one guy is definitely not, you know, on our side, so to speak. But the inverse of that is those people are failures at protecting anybody, including themselves. And so, you know, we have to look out for number one, which is our own communities and one another. And actually, I think that's the strength of what Bettina was really talking about, is it wasn't that Bettina necessarily, you know, does anti-voting work. It sounds to me like you're just an excellent subversive and subverting the necessity of actually engaging in that system. And that's what I want to see more of, is more of us working more and more outside of it with alternatives that still fulfill the needs of our community.
Well, honestly, what's helped me not vacillate back and forth in that system, which, you know, the assimilated parts of us, you know, that path to, you know, decolonizing and unlearning has been traditional teachings about today. The system, like Anthony said, is crumbling. And it needs to get bad, so bad, sometimes for humans to actually see truth. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been shared that little tidbit by many elders from different nations. You know, people talk about prophecies and they kind of laugh at us. But there has been prophecies passed down that are very true to what is happening today. These prophetic times, we call them. Some of them have been so accurate time after time after time. It doesn't really matter to me whether others believe it. If you learn it and you choose to seek those oral teachings, it's hard not to believe it. And so I deeply, and I've been ripped up for this, believe in the chaos.
I love that quote.
As part of the repair. So I look forward to the crumble, and it's happening.
Onward toward Thunderdome.
For me, and my like lived experience, I don't see how anything could possibly get worse than it already is and has been. I think people really sensationalize a lot of the things that have been happening under the current occupant of the White House because it's so unveiled, but all the things that he has done has existed throughout my entire life and others. Mm-hmm. And so I think that would be, you know, something that, you know, might may or may not like soothe the fear of people that there's really no way that in my perspective that things could get worse for me or for really anyone that I fuck with who are mostly not white people. The only things that could get worse is probably going to be, you know, could be for white people, but I really don't see that happening, just because one fascist or another is going to be in the White House. So maybe I just kind of have a little bit of like, who gives a shit perspective about it. And it's kind of funny to me how, right now we're talking about this moment being really chaotic. When really, to me, it's not. I just see it as one, you know, it's kind of like we're in one part of this never-ending cycle that we have been living in, again, since Contact, where, you know, or maybe if I can even just culminate it into the last, you know, 50 years, since, like, the rise of technology, you know, we see brutality and murder happening, and then there's outrage and protest happening, and then people fight for police reforms, and then those police budgets increase so that they can implement the reforms, and then the murdering and the brutality continue to happen, and it just goes around and around in this never-ending loop. And so to me, what's happening right now is not chaotic. It's pretty par for the course for what we've been experiencing for centuries now. And really what would be the chaos, I think, would be, you know, abolition is like finally stepping out of that cycle completely. That's the type of chaos that I really want to see. And I'm seeing glimmers of it, but I still don't see a whole, you know, revolution happening. From what I see right now. Yeah, I think that's kind of just where I'm at right now with it.
It's interesting to hear these threads of accelerationism, and we haven't really broken that down. I don't know, Anthony, if you want to break that down a bit for our listeners, but I know we're trying to wrap up and not drag it out, but maybe I can also provide a bit of a definition of that, but you brought it up first.
Well, accelerationism, this is like just off the top of my head kind of a definition. Accelerationism is a term utilized primarily in the left circles to describe those that believe in one, either doing work toward the end result of societal collapse, or have no qualms against the notion of societal collapse because they believe in the end that they want to build something new. You know, it, whatever that may be, a utopian state, an anarchist commune, whatever it may be, it's something different than what is now because now has got to go. And so accelerationists are basically content to either watch as the world burns, for lack of a better term, or as it goes to that direction, or they're engaging and hoping to get it there even faster.
Yeah, so an accelerationist would probably go out and actually vote for Trump, even though they didn't agree with, you know, his policies or practices or ideology, just to push, you know, the state of fascism to be more clear, for example.
And I think,
voting for Obama just to piss off the other side.
It's actually the inverse in this particular scenario. It's the inverse of voting for harm reduction. So instead of voting for harm reduction in this particular case, it would be the opposite. You're voting to do more harm. And in under the auspices that the people can only take so much, and then they'll revolt. And that's what you're shooting for.
And my interest in accelerationism is in that these pillars of oppression that uphold this system, once they are destabilized, will fall. This whole system will fall. And so anything that helps to move that forward, I think, is better. And also, with accelerationism, it's much easier to fight the Nazi wearing a swastika on their arm than the institutional one, the one that is coded, that navigates as a legitimate representation of this system. And so, to me, it's better when it's clear and it's called out. As part of what I think people should be doing, I offer that we can accelerate indigenous resistance and liberation, that we can be creative about our tactics and strategies, we can be spontaneous, we can be dangerous, we can intervene in the violences of this system where it desecrates our sacred lands, where it attacks our bodies, where we find that space, we make it grow, we stabilize, proliferate the beautiful and powerful acts of mutual aid that we see happening today, the range of various forms of direct action, from reconnecting to our traditional food systems, restoring those lifeways, building up our knowledge and maintaining our spiritual practices. Those are very, very powerful actions. We also have to be intergenerational. We have people who organized and survived through the range of colonial regimes, from the Reagan eras, Bush eras, senior and junior, through the Clinton eras, through the Obama eras, and of course, you know, he was just as complicit in colonial violence, particularly against indigenous folks who are migrating, that have the experience, that have been through these cycles, because this is a cycle. It's not an exception, what we're facing. There are escalations, but it is more clear for us in this time. So what can we do to address that as openly as possible? And so I'm interested in direct action. I think that just having these discussions in our on our terms, in our cultural and social context, in organizing to address these hard issues, whether it's cleaning up abandoned uranium mines, whether it's addressing missing and murdered indigenous women, girls, trans, two-spirit relatives, whether it's addressing police violence in our communities, you know, we have the power to address these issues. The people always should remember that we have the power, and that sounds cliche, but I think that that's the critical focus that we become detached from when we look at electoral politics. I mean, we have to own the reality of the millions and millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars that these election cycles spend, when we could be putting those resources, material resources and energy and support to addressing, resolving a lot of these issues in our communities, rather than wasting it away on a process that happens once every 4 years or so, And then people go back to political comas in many ways. I'm interested in agitating people into a state of anti-colonial critical consciousness that helps to inform and drive our actions every day. That's the kind of political power, spiritual power, and understanding that colonization is war, and we have to address it on those terms.
What can I say? This is such an informative gathering. It could go on for days, addressing really hard topics about voting, colonialism, self-governance, you know, our own journeys in the work we're doing. Wonderful discussions. So thank you.
Nice. You're welcome back anytime. My words of departure kind of relate to accelerationism. I just think it's not about the vote. It's about the level of disillusionment and despondency. And the reason I think that is the case is I just think we need more of that. Because without that, you're not going to get people to actually see beyond the rose-colored glasses they've been fed and bullshit that they've been fed for decades upon decades about what's actually going on around them and then the country that they live in.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think I'm going to, my final thoughts really are going to be kind of an extension of my final thoughts on the last episode, where I really, when I imagine, you know, the future that I want to live in, I really see that decentering whiteness in all its forms, whiteness and the supremacy culture of voting, of politics, of nonprofits, of policing, you know, of having a certificate of Indian blood, of blood quantum, and all these things, which have, you know, been ingrained in our lives and in our spirits for centuries now. I really want to just live completely outside of that world of this world, and really see more community care happening, community networks of, you know, going out and cleaning up the mines and somehow, you know, obtaining the resources to do that. And it, you know, you can start really small too. Maybe instead of reading up on, you know, the political agenda of the day, you can connect with some undocumented single mom who lives in a tiny two-bedroom apartment who has five kids and is here on a U visa, or, you know, anything that goes against working through whiteness, I think is the future that I want to be part of, and that I'm going to participate and really from here on out. And I guess one thing that's been really liberating is the idea that, God, this might be a whole nother conversation, but of really getting ready for, to defend that idea that we can live without white supremacy. And that means, you know, getting armed, getting trained in self-defense. And that's part of community care to me, is being able to defend your relatives on the streets. I mean, we see our relatives on the streets being almost run over by fascists who know how to target our unsheltered relatives. And if the community care that day means I go stand on the corner with a gun to scare or agitate these fascists who want to murder my relatives, and that's what I'm going to do that day. So I really just like want to invoke people to really reflect on how each day they can do something that goes against what they've learned in their assimilation to whiteness and white supremacy.
Yeah, thank you so much, Bettina, for joining us, sharing this space, and digging deep into this conversation. And if you like the track that we've been blasting, it's from With War. It's called Merciless Indian Savages. And you can find them at withwar.bandcamp.com, as well as instagram.com/withxwar. We really look forward to extending this conversation beyond this broadcast into other spaces. Find us on social media and so forth. The zine, Voting is Not Harm Reduction, is in audio zine format as a companion piece to this episode, so please check that out. And we really look forward to the provocation, the agitation, digging deeper into a critical consciousness around these issues of power, power relationships. And we know that it doesn't stop here, but it continues with the actions that we take every day in our lives.
So throughout the podcast, we have made multiple references to a zine called Voting is Not Harm Reduction, and you can find that zine at www.indigenousaction.org. That's also where you'll be able to find this broadcast. You can also find it on any of the usual podcast platforms. We're also inviting you all to email us pictures of burning cop cars, any questions or topics you'd like to hear us go claws out on at iainfo@protonmail.com.
You have no authority. You will never win.